Good evening, everybody. Thank you for venturing out on this rather unappetizing, unattractive evening. I'm sure the proceedings will make up for the weather. So, my name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies and Fellow of this college. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker tonight, Mr. Rory Milson, who will give our termly lecture. These occasions are sponsored by really three institutions. First of all, the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is an independent think tank associated with this college. Second is the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, which is a research institute within the university doing empirical research into the role of law in society. And the third is the institution where we are now finding ourselves, that is Wolfson College. And it's a particular pleasure to be in this still relatively brand new auditorium, finished just a year or so ago. So tonight we have Mr. Milson. First of all, I'll just say a little bit about the topic. Rory has been very instrumental, indeed I've said almost written, this very large report here called The Legality Under International Law of Targeted Killings by Drones Launched by the United States. This was published earlier this year in June and is produced by the New York City Bar. Rory, I'm sure, will tell you more about that and how it came about. But it is a very, very closely argued and very wide-ranging and authoritative document, probably the first of its kind, which tries to get to grips with, tries to just understand the legal principles governing this matter. And as you can see from the size of the report, these are not straightforward principles by any means. And again, I'm looking forward to Rory's exposition of some of the issues that arise. I think although this report is mainly concentrating on the legal framework, of course, there are important policy implications that follow, and not least, there are important moral principles to consider. And so law, justice and society are again, in this very idea, are closely interrelated. So I hope Rory might take us a little bit beyond the legal framework to talk a bit about the policy issues or the implications and one or two of the moral dilemmas that arise. So Rory and Oxford go back a long way. Rory was a Rhodes Scholar from South Africa back in the 70s. We both were briefly together at Magdalen College, and then Rory went back to Yale University where he'd already completed an undergraduate degree and he entered the law school. He then went into practice as an attorney and became a partner of Cravath, Swain & Moore, one of the celebrated law firms in New York City, where he remains to this day. He's been very much a litigator and now becoming more involved in issues such as killing by drones, arbitrations, and things classical. So Rory, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Oxford after all these years, and we look forward to your talk. Rory will speak for about 45, 50 minutes, and then there'll be quite a bit of time for comment and discussion. Thanks very much, Rory.
Thank you. One thing I asked Dennis to do is that if you're a litigator, the most dangerous place that you can stand is between me and the microphone. So maybe, Dennis, you can keep me on track to being limited me to 45 minutes unless I can be disciplined. Dennis was talking about a long time ago when we were here. That raises an issue that has interested me for a long time, which is how do insurgencies go away? When Dennis and I were here, there was the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany was blowing up things. The Red Brigade in Italy kidnapped a former prime minister, cut his ear off, and then killed him. So there was a whole series of insurgencies going on in Europe. At the same time, in Syria, there was the Muslim Brotherhood, who in 1982, famously, President Assad, the father of the current president, invited people to the town and massacred them. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, if this is the way that we have to deal with an insurgency like that, we have a problem, because we're never going to kill large numbers of people in a circumstance like that. So I'm wiser than I used to be, in that the son of President Assad is finding out that maybe that's not the way that you have to deal with an insurgent group. And we, on the other hand, are maybe engaging in more of the sort of conduct that I thought that we would never do. I would say our decision to infringe on the sovereignty of other nations by sending troops or weapons in and to kill adversaries is significant in many ways, legal, moral, practical. The report that we spent so long on focuses on just one aspect, the legality under international law. We don't even really get into American law for a variety of different reasons, but I thought that we should be having a debate on the subject, and every time we got into a debate, people would mix up morality, law, and practicality. And I said, you know, this is not any way to have a debate. We need to have a platform where we can have the international law basis and decide some things are legal and some things are not. And after that, we can get into a discussion of practicality. Obviously, if you want to have just a moral basis, you don't even have to get to my basis. But I thought the debate was being degraded by the fact that we had so many things, so many different topics. Some people encouraged me to do this, saying we need to have an example for other groups when they get drones that they can use. And I'm a little bit skeptical of that, because I think other states, when they get drones that they're going to use, they're not going to say, well, the United States did this, or even if they do, that's not going to guide their actions. And I think that non-governmental actors, they're hard to deter anyway. So the notion of doing this was largely so that we could have a basis that we could talk of. And once we got some sort of agreement on that, we could then discuss many of the other issues that Dennis is talking about. Let me say a few things about drones first. Anytime that there's a new technology that you get, especially a technology for killing people, there is resistance to that technology. And I suppose, Izzy, if you could put up my first slide, and it goes back to the Lateran Council of 1139, where Pope Innocent II prohibited under anathema that murderous art of crossbowmen and archers, which is hateful to God, to be employed against Christians and Catholics from now on. So the crossbow and the longbow were declared anathema because people didn't like projectiles coming from a long way away, and you didn't like to kill people by, you know, unless you could see them. I do note that the use of the crossbow against infidels remained lawful, so the Pope could keep his eye on the ball. We could take a look at the next slide, which is a literary slide, which is Don Quixote. Don Quixote is against artillery because it comes from a long way away, and there is a long literature against snipers. Snipers are hated in battle, and so people are against drones on some of the same reason. I would say that I don't really buy that. Drones are just a way of killing people. And how we think of drones shouldn't be affected by the fact that drones come from a long way. There's also stuff that says people get an Xbox mentality because they're sitting in New Mexico or whatever, and they're following, and it's like a game. I think that much of this has to do with what people's view of a drone, you know, whether they like drones or not. The Xbox mentality, you know, you could make just as strong an argument that says drones, that if you're dropping a bomb from 43,000 feet on someone, it's, you know, you care even less about them. On the other hand, I would say that there are people who say we're hopeful that drones are a more humane way of killing people because we can kill them more accurately. The professor who gave me these two quotes from Cervantes and the Lateran Council wonderfully said, "War kills civilians, period." So I don't think we should think of drones as particularly evil or particularly good. The reason, on the other hand, that drones are being used much more is, one, they're cheaper than having a regular plane. And two, I think probably even more importantly, no one has to write a letter saying, "I regret to inform you that your son or daughter was killed." And there isn't a ceremony at Dover Air Force Base in the United States when they bring back the bodies of the soldiers. So we've started to use drones as a substitute for putting soldiers on the ground, boots on the ground, and it's very convenient to do that. When we come to trying to look at the legal issues on drones, we have a couple of complications. One, I should tell you that in one of the biggest political issues I had in drafting a 200-page report was this first point. People really didn't want to agree with me, but it is true. The United States has spent a long time making sure there isn't an international court that can resolve these issues. The United States essentially, going back to the Reagan era and in every president since then, has essentially blocked the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, which deals with state disputes. And I'm going to be talking to you about two aspects of international law which wonderfully have names that are very similar. One is called jus ad bellum, which has to do with a complaint between two sovereign states, one that the other one is invading its territory, and the other is called jus in bello, and that has to do with killing people. So jus ad bellum, the sovereignty principle, the International Court of Justice is very unlikely ever to be able to have a case that says the United States is violating someone's sovereignty. The United States has gone even further in making sure that its citizens and its soldiers are not subject to the International Court of Justice. I, in fact, got a call from a Dutch client some number of years ago saying that there was a statute in the United States, and I haven't checked to see whether it's true, he swore it was true, that said if the International Court was prosecuting an American, that the United States had to invade to take the person back. When I bring this up with American scholars, they all go, "Oh yeah, that was the," and they have a name for this, and I don't know whether it's true, but I'm telling you that it is unlikely, even though people have come up with suggestions that maybe England or Australia could be subject to in one of these proceedings. We're unlikely ever to get a definitive ruling, and in international law, in fact, they're not always definitive because they don't believe in stare decisis. So that is one complication. Another complication is that the United States has been economical with the truth and the facts on this whole program, and there's very little that you can know, and we'll discuss that in a little bit. You will hear me say that much of that is unwise, even though most of it is not illegal, but it is difficult enough to know what's going on in Western Pakistan because of all the fighting and how remote it is, but there's no information coming out from the United States. And in fact, one of our audience members here tonight is, I believe, is the source of some of the information that we gathered from Pakistan. And the third complication is that much of what's written about international law is what people's policy preferences are. And so we get legal opinions, if you will, or comments on the law that are just what they think. And I had a symposium recently where I told Dennis I managed to get the left and the right to attend. I suppose I had two comments about that. They said to me, "Wow, you're the only one who's actually taken the writings from both groups and put them together and analyzed them, each one on the merits, even if we don't agree with you." And the second comment was, "I couldn't get the center to come, but that's because, I don't know why, we have too little public debate on this." So let me go to, I've already mentioned to you that I was going to talk about two separate principles or bodies of law. So let me go to Jus ad bellum, which says, is it lawful for the United States to invade, if you will? And it doesn't matter whether the invasion is, as I said earlier, is the SEALs going into Pakistan to kill bin Laden, or whether you use a drone. It makes, under international law, it makes no difference. So if we could take a look at the slide here, which is the bedrock principle of the United Nations, and it's Article 2.4, and it says all members, now members are states, and shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state, or in any, and then it goes on. So this is Nuremberg, okay? People got prosecuted at Nuremberg for hostile war, and then after the war, there is a prohibition on the use of force, or the threat of the use of force, and it's phrased in a funny way. It says, against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. But let's just assume that unless there's an exception, you're not allowed to send your drones into another state. Now, there are three exceptions. One is if the Security Council authorizes the use of force. That's not relevant here, but I believe it happened in Libya, or at least the European nations and the United States said it happened in Libya. I think the Russians tend to say that it didn't happen, but you can have a violation of an exception to 2.4 if you have the Security Council approval. The second exception is if there is consent. So, and I think I put up a slide that says in Yemen, at least, I don't know who the government is today, but there was consent in Yemen And so there isn't a issue of sovereignty violation in Yemen, and there are lots of facts on, and in fact, you can see in the bottom quote there, there is a, let me explain what a special rapporteur is. The United Nations appoints experts in the field to make studies and to issue reports, and there's a very well regarded English QC named Ben Emerson, who is actually a, he has nuanced views. He can actually he's not one of the people who is necessarily always, if I can call it, left wing. Although left wing and right wing in this context often become the same. And you can see he's saying, I spoke to Yemen and they consented. The country that's the most, well, let me, so the other states where we've had drones are Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Mali, and Libya. There isn't any, to the extent there's a government in those countries, they've said, please come in and use drones for us. And, you know, Somalia has had more governments, and as I think about it, Dennis, you're talking to me about failed constitutions. Somalia must have had one of the record for failed constitutions, numbers of failed constitutions in the last few years. The country that's most problematic from this point of view is Pakistan. Because Pakistan plainly for a long time was saying publicly, gosh, you can't come here. And then we know from WikiLeaks, which I see you're having a movie on soon, we know from WikiLeaks that they were saying at the same time, you know, please, you can come here and use your drone against that guy as long as you kill this guy for me, because I want him dead. And so they had a very complicated game going on, and I want to come back and talk to that about that in a while. But Pakistan, for the longest time, was saying publicly, don't do this. And on the other hand, the highest officials were saying, go ahead and do it. I believe that that has changed in recent times. And that they are now, I obviously don't have WikiLeaks, but that enough high Pakistani officials have said, don't do it, that we have to assume that they're telling the truth. I should add that I have taken flack for this position and, from a number of people who were saying, we should just assume that they are not, you know, that they're being duplicitous on here. And I happen to believe that in this context, as in others, that no means no. And I will come back and talk about the international law ramifications of that in a second. Let me turn to the third exception, which is the Article 51 of the UN Charter, which with any luck is up there, and it says, nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations. I have to tell you that those few phrases probably take up about 50 to 75 pages of a report trying to analyze exactly what that means. Going from the inherent right of individual, and we go back to a wonderful case called involving Daniel Webster, and I forget who the English lord was, and they're writing backwards and forwards about a ship in Canada and self-defense. But I think the right view, at least after September 11th, and I think you see something of a sea change, not only with, well, you have the Security Council right after September 11th saying you can have self-defense against someone who is not a state because the question comes up in, I mentioned to you in 2-4 that it's an issue of the relationship between states. We now want to have a situation where the United States, a state, is going to invade the sovereignty of another state, not because of what the state did, but because of an actor inside the state, a non-state actor, has done something which is not necessarily attributable to the state. And I think you see a relatively clear change in attitude after 2001 by practically all states, because the Russians are having the same problem in incursions into Russia. So they're giving the same sorts of analysis that says, boy, if you are unable or unwilling to keep these people under control, then I am going to be free to invade your state. So I won't go into a lot of the analysis that comes with, and I have to say that much of the United States rhetoric on this gets well out ahead of the rhetoric or the analysis of the legal position of other states. But so if we come now to, we've looked at Article 51 and we've said you can react, and we're going to come to this in thinking about ISIS and the current U.S. position, that you can infringe on the sovereignty of another state in self-defense against a non-state actor. What do you have to do then? If we can go to the next slide, it says, measures taken by members in the exercise of this right of self-defense, this is under Article 51 that we just looked at, shall be immediately reported to the Security Council, and it goes on to say, that says, if you are impinging on the sovereignty of another state, you don't have Security Council authority, you don't have consent, then you can only be doing it if you're acting in self-defense. And if you're acting in self-defense, you have to make a disclosure to the United States, I mean to the United Nations. So if we look at the next slide, we will see that in 1998, the United States sent a notice to the Security Council about bin Laden in Somalia. And it said, I'm having problems with Somalia and I'm going to take action on this. I have to say that if there'd been drones in that day, the history of the world would have been different. We wouldn't have had Black Hawk down and all of these other issues. But here is the first disclosure in a chain of... Now, if we could put up the next one, and I'm afraid the caption on the next one is wrong. It shouldn't say ISIS. Someone got ahead of themselves. This is the disclosure that's sent on 7th of October 2001, having to do with the September 11 attacks. Here, it's a slightly different context in that, the notice is sent to Afghanistan saying, you must deal with bin Laden. And the Taliban is then the government of Afghanistan. And here is an interesting wrinkle on it, because there isn't any doubt that here they're going to take action against the government. It's not like Pakistan, where you are blowing up people and they're just living in Pakistan. Here there's going to be regime changes coming in terms of an invasion, and it's going to unseat the Taliban. And then what happens is that the Taliban gets unseated and the next government invites the United States in, so there's consent. What we then see ever since then is fighting in northwest Pakistan having to do with this battle. But if you look at the disclosure, Nowhere does it say anything that I'm going to impinge on the sovereignty of Pakistan. So the letter becomes, you know, my view is when you look at this letter, it's out of date. The United States now has an obligation when there is no consent in Pakistan, by Pakistan, to send a similar letter saying, I am doing this I'm taking action in Pakistan. And after all, soldiers were sent into Pakistan to kill bin Laden, and it's not as if these are small incursions, these are relatively large incursions. And I believe that the United States is now in violation of international law, that it has not sent this letter. Why am I stressing this letter? I will come back and talk about what I think is going on, which is not going to be a legal conclusion. If I could then just put up the last slide, or the next slide, and this one is about ISIS. So the current, what's going on at the moment is that Iraq has sent a letter that says there are people coming out of Syria who are committing armed attacks on me, and I therefore must be allowed to retaliate against these people and make incursions into Syria, and this is my self-defense rationale. And so the United States hasn't said that we are going to make self-defense with respect to Syria. They're saying, the first letter, they come from Iraq and they say, we have a self-defense issue. And then they say, gosh, we've asked the United States to help us. And you will recall that when I read to you from Article 51, that it was talking about collective self-defense. And so there is, it seems to me that the United States has set this one up correctly, there is then a subsequent letter from the United States, which is not, I don't have a slide on, that says, gosh, I'm going to do this, and I'm giving you my Article 51 disclosure. So I'll come back and talk very briefly in a couple of minutes as to what I think is going on, why the United States didn't send the Article 51 disclosure about Pakistan, because you know, if you look at the letters, the authors of the letters all knew, they copy it. It's like coming from Cravath, Swain & Moore, a corporate document. Let me turn now to Yossin Bello, killing people. In the tradition of international law, we like to give things similar names. So Yossin Bello is also called international humanitarian law, which is humanitarian law, I suppose, if you think of the other aspects of Yossin Bello, because after all, the parts I'm talking about of killing people are not necessarily the first thing you think about. It's also called the law of armed conflict. There is also a body of law which has developed quite dramatically in the last few years called international human rights law. So that's very confusing when you're first trying to get into this. You have international human rights law and international humanitarian law. You should assume that international human rights law, it is unlawful to kill someone. At least you should assume that it's unlawful to kill someone with a drone where you're sitting a long way away. People are always positing, there's someone walking along outside Grand Central Station with a nuclear bomb in his pocket, and, we need to kill him essentially immediately. But it is, in a law enforcement context, it is usually unlawful to kill someone. The difference with international humanitarian law is that you are permitted to kill people under certain circumstances. So what makes the difference here? And the difference is the existence of an armed conflict. Now, armed conflict, we have many pages in the report trying to figure out whether this is an international armed conflict or a non-international armed conflict. And in fact, any dispute between a state and a non-state actor is a non-international armed conflict. And then you have to look to see, because the non-international armed conflict, you no longer have a state, so you don't know, is this really worthy of being an armed conflict or not? You have to look at the cases that come out of largely Yugoslavia, the old Yugoslavian cases, and they talk about who can be a party to a non-international armed conflict, and you have to have a dispute that has severity, and so we're already talking judgment, and then you need to have the non-state actor to have a degree of organization so that they can have a command structure. I think that there is some, well, first let's take a look at the U.S. position. And when I was saying earlier about economical with the facts, you have to get this out of a leaked, you get this out of a leaked white paper, if I could put that up. It says, there's a non-international armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces. And if I could then go to the next slide, you will see there's a definition of associated forces. This is getting into very bizarre, because you get Al-Qaeda here and you get Al-Qaeda in Iraq and you get, and we now have the peculiar situation that ISIS, which is terrorizing the Middle East, actually split off, was kicked out of Al-Qaeda for being too wacko. So you have these groups that don't necessarily have anything much to do with each other, but the United States is trying to put forward a rationale, and co-belligerency is really what the United States wants to say, is they're conspirators. But we all know that there isn't a, you know, conspiracy is a common law concept, so they can't say that. And the United States really, I think there's an armed conflict going on in each of these states. And we can put up some slides, and I think the next slide. If you look, Emerson, who I mentioned to you earlier, says, the overwhelming majority of remotely pilot aircraft strikes are being conducted within conventional theaters of armed conflict. He's actually talking there. A lot of drones get fired in Afghanistan, and people are not arguing, and Iraq, whether there's an armed conflict there. And you will see, and I'll just flash through some slides, Amnesty International describes they had a long report in September of 2013 that describes the armed conflicts in Pakistan. Human Rights Watch had an even better report in September of 2013 on Yemen, and they said, look, there's an armed conflict going on there. Now, what is interesting to me is that the United States, we've had a lot of rhetoric going back to Bush's global war on terror, and subsequently the stuff I've been putting up from Obama. And it seems to me that all this discussion as to whether there is a global armed conflict with some sort of overall Al-Qaeda is actually not what's going on. What's going on is that we have a whole series of armed conflicts, and the United States, wisely or not, is coming in on the side of the government in a civil war in each of these. On the other hand, the United States seems unwilling to say, you know, this is not some overall strategy. I'm just on the side of the government. And in fact, we have a strange situation now, which is actually not that unsurprising, that we're killing the opponents of the Assad regime in from Syria, when, you know, a few weeks ago we were thoroughly against the Assad regime. But, you know, we are, it's very unclear as to what it is that the United States says that the armed conflict is, and I think we're just intervening on the side of a government in a variety of countries. Let me talk very briefly about the principles of international humanitarian law, and to tell you that, in fact, much of what you read in the newspaper about the complaints, much of that is wrong. The principal issue in international humanitarian law is up there from the Geneva Conventions, or additional protocol to the Geneva, says civilians shall enjoy the protection against military attack unless and for such time as they take direct part in hostilities. Now, this is something that's written with an international armed conflict in mind. It says, I have a soldier on one side and a soldier on another side, and let's just assume a general proposition. If there's an armed conflict going on, they can shoot each other. That's okay. Now, what you have when you get to a non-international armed conflict, one side is wearing uniforms and the other isn't. And interestingly enough, the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is sort of the definitive arbiter on this, they had a choice. Do you say that when you're looking at the phrase of direct part in hostilities, is there the person who is a non-state actor? He's not wearing a uniform. If you're wearing a uniform, even in that context, you can be killed. So is it fair, in a sense, that the non-state actor gets a pass because he's not wearing a uniform? And the International Red Cross said, we're not going to give an advantage to non-state actors like that. And if you look at this next quote from the Red Cross, you will see that it sets up a group that is not a civilian who can be killed. And it's if you are a continuous command function, so if you are in the sort of executive of Al-Qaeda, even though you're not doing anything at the moment, you know, with a gun, you can be killed just as if you were a colonel in the competing army. And I'll skip the next slide, which says that, you know, you can go, if you are not in that command function, then when you've got a gun, you can, if you're doing something that's dangerous, then you can be killed. Now, I say that this says that most of what you know from the press is incorrect, because there's always a lot of stuff in the press that's saying signature strikes are bad, and because they have you're looking at sort of the uniform of the non-state actor, and kill lists are bad. And here you have another rapporteur who says, hey, it depends on what the signatures are, that this is actually the right way to do it. You just need to have the right information, which of course that relates to the principle of precaution, which I'm going to skip, except to say that my friend Rosa Brooks says war kills innocent civilians, period. I will skip over the other requirements of Jus in Bello, and just to say, and come to a last couple of points on, is there a duty to disclose? Because this is where I got the most flack from NGOs. There is, I've told you in Article 51 on sovereignty, there's this limited duty to disclose. We then come to the question, much bigger question, as to is there a duty to disclose when you've done a drone strike that's killed someone? Now, we're talking on the Jus in Bello. Now, a former rapporteur, a very distinguished NYU professor, says states should publicly identify the rules of international law they consider to provide a basis for any targeted killings they undertake. I've looked to see, you know, every time you look to see what the basis for the assertions, it vanishes. State international law is governed by treaties, and other than 51 that I've talked to you about, there isn't a treaty, and it's also governed by custom. And one thing I'm relatively sure of is that when you have a war, there isn't a custom of international, of transparency and full disclosure. There is in, you can see Emerson is saying, this is actually an interesting, I kidded the rapporteurs about this a little bit. They say, in any case in which the civilians have been or appear to have been killed, the state responsible is under an obligation to conduct a prompt, independent, and impartial fact-finding inquiry. Correct. True. Okay? And then he says, and to provide a detailed public explanation. You go, where did you get that from? In the other rapporteur, Hines, that I put up, one of his assistants said to me, you know, Rory, it's really unfair. You take our sites and then you expose that that the stuff that's saying there's disclosure, that it doesn't follow from the sites. And they're saying, we're making a policy recommendation. I'm going, yeah, but you should say I'm making a policy recommendation, but because it's not there, and it's not, I don't think, when we're trying to force the governments to do things, to be making arguments that are not correct is not right. I would come back and switch in my last couple of comments to what I call in my last slide is ostrich diplomacy. Now, I am originally from South Africa, as Dennis said, so I can tell you that I know that ostriches don't, in fact, put their heads in the sand. It is untrue, but the calumny is there, and what I think is going on is that the United States is, by not making, say, the Article 51 disclosure, it is allowing Pakistan to play this ambivalent game and the Saudis to play this ambivalent game. And here is the former director of national intelligence saying that, I have to tell you that he got canned, and I suspect he got canned for saying things like this. If you think about, remember I started by saying in 1982 the Muslim Brotherhood was trying to overthrow Saddam, whatever, Assad. That problem has existed for a long time. And it is a problem that is, in the first instance, addressed to the states in the Middle East. They are the ones, you know, the great Satan isn't going to go first. And the game that they're playing is so that they can say to their opponents, oh, you know, we're against what the great Satan is doing, but, the great Satan is doing exactly what they want. And this is what Blair is saying here. And I think it's a huge mistake for us if one looks at the policy, it's not working, okay? It's demonstrably not working. It's getting worse. And our letting the states sort of walk away from the fact that they are, you know, at the first instance in risk in ISIS taking them out is bizarre. Let's say one other thing on secrecy. The United States drone program is operated by two groups. One is the Army and one is the CIA. The CIA, its charter is everything that they didn't happen. It's if you ask someone, did the CIA do this, they will look at you and it's no comment. Having the CIA do this drones program, which is, seems to me, there are two things going on. One is we're killing people saying, I need to kill you. But there's also a publicity war going on with the rest of the country. And it's very difficult to have a publicity war when the CIA screws up and it kills a bunch of people in a wedding party, which they plainly did once. And everyone can scream and shout and said, you did this. And the CIA is going, what? It's you can't respond when you're in a PR war with people. Sometimes you didn't kill someone in a wedding party, but they can say it's a wedding party. And so it's essentially irrational to be sort of hampering yourself like that, because in a lot of these countries, it's odd from our point of view, but there is a sort of an established system. If you kill someone by mistake, there are payments and other things that happen. And we have disabled ourselves because of a bureaucratic decision. And my last slide is President Obama saying this in May of 2014. By then, he's been president for 6 years. What I said is not a large about transparency and getting it away from the CIA. I will say this for him. He said exactly the same thing in May 2013. So nothing is happening. So I suppose in terms of, I've given you an outline of the legal principles, but to say that in a way there aren't really a lot of legal issues here. The public debate should be, do you believe this is wrong and whatever, and is it working? And I'll let you all form your own conclusion on that.
Thank you, Robert.